The information in this podcast is provided for education and research information only. It is not a substitute for professional health advice.
If you're trying to get pregnant, or you are pregnant, and you feel a little bit overwhelmed by all you need to know, then this is the right podcast for you. Welcome to the show. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney, and this is The Kick, your expert-led podcast that delivers the essentials of growing a baby. Make sure you head to our website, growmybaby.com.au, to get some awesome free tools like our Pregnancy Knowledge Checker to help you feel like you got this.
Welcome everyone to The Kick. I'm Bridget Maloney.
And I'm obstetrician Dr. Patrick Maloney.
And this episode today is one which we're terming as fascinomas.
Those strange, unusual diagnoses that you heard about once, don't know if it's real, don't know if it's not real.
Yeah, and, you know, you heard the friend of a sister had something and, you know, all of a sudden you got fascinated by it. You might have done a bit of a Google deep dive.
Yeah.
Yeah. We want to point out, though, that these are fascinomas to people who don't have these issues. For people that perhaps have one of the issues that we're going to be talking about, they're definitely not fascinations.
No, they're not. You know, these are real healthcare problems with that for real human beings that need help. And the rest, we're allowed to be interested in it. Yeah, and people often ask about it.
Yeah,
yeah.
Well, that's one of the reasons why we wanted to do the podcast, because we often get asked about all these different topics.
Absolutely.
But, yeah. And it is a bit tabloidy, Pat, isn't it? Like we were just talking about that off air about, you know, how do we do this so we sort of respect those people that have any of these issues without it sounding tabloidy.
Yeah, that's right.
One question, Pat, we get so much is all the different shapes of uteruses. And I had to look it up and see whether I'm supposed to be saying uteruses or uteri. But I'm fine saying uteruses, aren't I?
Good. Uteruses is correct. Uteruses. Good.
Uteruses.
The embryology of the uterus, how the uterus forms in a female fetus, is reasonably well understood. And most of the anatomical variations in the uterus that we see all the time can be traced back to various issues that happen during embryological development, as the bit of the baby that's going to become the reproductive tract and the urinary tract form at a similar time in fetal development, and in ways that can predictably lead to anatomical variations in the adult woman, sometimes paired with problems in the urinary tract.
All right, so maybe it might be useful, Patty, can you talk about just really what, is there a variation even on normal?
Yeah, I guess there's variations in normal, and the most common of those would be whether the uterus is antiverted or retroverted. So that just means that if we imagine looking up the vagina towards the cervix, in most women, beyond the cervix, the uterus will flop forward towards the bladder. And in a smaller number of women, it flops backwards towards the bowel. But they're both normal.
Yep. And do either of them have any flow-on effects with pregnancy or...?
No, I think they used to think it did.
Yeah.
So I think they used to think that retroverted uterus was an abnormality. And I think somewhere in the textbooks of gynecology, there's a description of a operation to sort of bend it back the other way. And I think that was based on an out-of-date understanding of what caused perhaps infertility or pelvic pain or something. Yeah. But it's normal.
Yep.
Yeah.
So our oldest son is 20, and I have been told that I have a retroverted uterus way back then. Who knows? Well, I don't have one now, but and I think I was even explained back then that at some point in the pregnancy that the pain that I was experiencing was the uterus growing and flipping from a retroverted position to an antiverted position.
Well, I think that definitely happens during pregnancy. As the baby gets bigger, it kind of straightens everything out. But I don't think that necessarily causes pain in mine.
Yeah, right. Mm. Well, I just think just people trying to find a cause for what was just a probably normal occurrence.
A normal physiological process.
Yeah. All right, I'm going to get on to some of the more unusual shaped uteruses now. So the first one is a Didelphus. What is a Didelphus uterus?
Uterus Didelphus is basically duplication of the uterus. So there's sort of two. There's often two cervixes.
Wow.
And occasionally two vaginas.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And that's something that, every gynecologist has seen one or two cases of. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. But, now I am fascinated.
Yeah. But it's very interesting. It's very interesting for that person and their obstetric life that you can certainly have a pregnancy in each one
at different times.
Yeah, I guess more likely to different. There might be a case report of in each one at the same time. Certainly, you know, someone will say I got pregnant in my left uterus on one pregnancy, and then a couple of years later got pregnant in my right uterus. And
wow.
So in the full case where there's a duplicated vagina, then each one seems to end in a normal cervix, and beyond that, there's a often small but otherwise duplicated uterus.
But that is that I've got so many questions. So there's only one ovulation cycle still. Like they've still got one set of ovaries.
Yep. So the ovaries form separately to the uterus.
Right.
So that doesn't all form at the same time.
Yeah.
So for example, if you've got no uterus at all, you'll still often have two ovaries.
Right.
Yeah.
And so is it just by chance where that egg ends up, whether it's in one uterus or the other?
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, you wouldn't know whether that's going to be neat and alternatively lodge in one or the other. It's just by chance.
Yeah.
Yeah. With a Didelphus uterus, does that is that a risky pregnancy?
I don't think so. In fact, I think lots of cases of these functional abnormalities of the reproductive tract, i.e. the anatomy is unusual or abnormal, but it works fine. Lots of them are never diagnosed.
Right.
So the one case I saw once of a woman with a complete Didelphus and two vaginas, we only found that when she was had a hysterectomy much later in life.
Wow.
Yeah.
But she would have known that she had two vaginas.
No, she didn't. She didn't know that. No. So that had just never, she just never quite established that. Yeah.
Wow. God, that is fascinating. And I'm assuming if you've only seen one in your whole career.
Yeah.
Pretty rare.
That's rare.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, we have been asked to ask you about a unicornuate uterus.
So unicornuate uterus is if you can imagine that the uterus sort of forms a bit on the left and a bit on the right, and then as the embryological development continues, they kind of join together in the middle. And when two structures join together in the middle, I guess if one side the development fails and the other side it doesn't, then you wind up with a uterus that's about half as big as it should be, and it's got one attached tube, but on the other side there's nothing, and so that's a unicornuate uterus.
And do we know if they've got two ovaries, can that ovary still produce an egg like somebody that's lost a fallopian tube?
Yeah, and just like someone who's had one ectopic, lost a tube to one ectopic, you can still get a good. They'll typically have two ovaries, and you can still get a good egg from the other side.
And you've told me so many times the uterus is a very stretchy organ.
Yeah, most of these go all right. Yeah. So I've dealt with three or four cases of pregnancies. At least three or four cases of pregnancies in unicornuate uteruses. And it's very stretchy. Yeah. So someone with a unicornuate uterus might have, a higher chance of premature labor and delivery. But typically that small uterus can stretch and hold on to a baby for long enough to have a live baby.
Mm, wow. You've just described the uterus developing separately. Is that what a septate uterus is?
Yeah, sort of. The idea is that the two embryological structures will fuse in the midline, and when two things sort of fuse in the midline, there'll be a wall between them, and then that wall's supposed to disappear. And that way you get the uterine shape that we all know and love with its two halves, but an empty cavity in the middle. And if that wall in the middle doesn't disappear, then that's what a septate uterus is. There's a big wall up the middle.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And is that something somebody has to have removed if they want to have a pregnancy?
Yes and no. That sort of thing is something that might explain infertility in somebody who was having trouble conceiving.
Yeah.
And when they had an expert ultrasound or MRI or something, that they can see the septum. And these midline problems can affect the upper vagina and even the vaginal opening as well. So the ones at the vaginal opening have got this. There's a sort of a just a little sort of septum, a little wall going up the middle of the vagina from 6 to 12 o'clock, and that's easy to remove. The upper vagina one's a little more complicated, and in the uterus needs a proper operation to take the wall down and reestablish one normal cavity.
And it's important to have one normal cavity, or can is it a stretchy structure as well, like a unicornuate? Like would a septate uterus stretch to accommodate a baby or not?
Yeah, it does. And there's a thing called subseptate where the uterus is just looks like it's sort of got two halves on the inside and a bit of a wall. And lots of those never get diagnosed if you're not looking.
Yeah.
Yeah, because if it's not causing infertility, don't find it.
And you said that it impacts the vagina. Is that when somebody might think that they've got a septate or something unusual about the anatomy?
Yeah. So someone might notice a significant vaginal septum just at the time of first intercourse.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Gosh, and, you know, at that time they're probably really young. Well, maybe not, yeah, but, you know, teenagers or early 20s or whatever, and, like, that'd be the last thing they'd be looking for.
Absolutely. So these are complicated health problems that need a really gentle approach.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. There's one more, isn't there? Well, one more on my list, which is a bicornuate.
You're listening to The Kick with Dr. Pat and Bridget.
Hi, everyone. Well, we've got a milestone coming up and we want to celebrate it with you, our listeners. May 7th, we're going to launch our 100th episode of The Kick. And guess what? We couldn't have done it without our listeners. To celebrate, we are asking for you to tell us your biggest tips about getting pregnant, being pregnant, becoming a mother, birth, anything that you think future listeners might benefit from. And we want 100 voices. As a gift to you for adding your voice, we will give everyone a whopping 50% discount to any of our programs. You can use this yourself or gift it to a friend. To add your voice, go to our website, growmybaby.com.au. We will then put a selection of the voices together for our 100th episode. That sounds like fun, doesn't it? So the website again is growmybaby.com.au. We are so excited to hear all your biggest tips for future mamas just like you.
Yeah, bicornuate uterus is where that, I guess, that process of midline fusion doesn't quite occur properly, and you get a uterus that looks more like it's got sort of two horns coming out of it rather than the normal shape, if you can imagine from the textbook. These ones are usually fairly functional. Okay, hey, there's an operation to turn it into a more ordinary shaped uterus in someone who would be mostly experiencing infertility, but lots of people got bicornuate uterus and it works just fine.
Right. I think so everybody gets a really good idea about what we're talking about. We'll have to do we'll put a link in the show notes to pictures.
Yeah.
So if you can get the pictures and listen along and look at the pictures.
Mm.
So it would be fascinating, I think, for somebody to understand what they've been told, you know, to put that to a picture and sort of work out, well, what does that mean for their future, I don't know, sex life, fertility.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. And there's one other one which has been in the news lately, and that is no uterus and the uterus transplant.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So it's certainly a well-described problem that you can be born with no uterus at all. And that's a problem called malarian agenesis, no uterus at all. So often the the vagina will end in a sort of a rudimentary small cervix, and above that there's nothing, and there's usually normal development of the ovaries, so the ovaries would be there. And that has been a problem that traditionally has had no terrific solution, except that in the last decade or so there's been some major advances in uterine transplantation.
Mm.
So I mean, if you think about it, the uterus is kind of the perfect organ to transplant. The plumbing of it is fairly simple, easier than the heart, I guess.
Yeah. We can transplant those.
You can attach it to the top of the vagina, and then the best part, I think, is that when you don't need it anymore, you take it out again.
Mm.
So unlike the heart, you don't have to worry about really that much about rejection. I mean, I'm sure they do, and I'm sure it's a thing. But if you're lucky enough to have a uterine transplant using, say, your mother's uterus, and it works well enough for you to have a pregnancy, then after that pregnancy is done, if you start to run into problems with rejection, you can take it out again.
Yeah.
Plenty of women walking around have had a hysterectomy, so that's not it's not an organ you necessarily need to keep. And if we look at the problems that have plagued other forms of organ transplantation, working out how to do the operation's only been the start. It's working out how to keep that organ in that patient long term without the immune system rejecting it. That's been one of the major issues.
And what sort of surgeon does a uterine transplant?
Well, obstetricians and gynecologists do, but it's super, super specialized stuff. Mm. The special skills that your average run-of-the-mill ONG wouldn't have would be in connecting all the blood vessels.
Yeah.
So you have to be able to hook it up to a nearby circulation in the woman who's born without the uterus to run the blood supply.
All right. Well, when we wanted to do this episode on fascinomas, and we're just really pulling all different sort of questions together that we've got over the last few years.
Yeah.
But I also put a story on our Instagram and said, okay, let's talk about fascinomas. What have you got? And yes, we did get all the uteruses that we've just gone through, but I'm going to start with some of the other questions we received too, Patty. So number one was, can you get a period when you are pregnant?
Yeah, you can bleed when you're pregnant, and people commonly do. I think it's probably a bit misleading to call it a period. It's not a period that's happening like a period does under control from the uterus, from the ovaries, where the uterus is shedding its lining. That's obviously not happening during a pregnancy. But it's certainly possible to bleed and to bleed, I guess, coincidentally, fairly regularly, in a way that would make the person think they were still getting a normal period. And even if it was irregular, if your normal period was irregular and you got pregnant and bled irregularly for usual pregnancy reasons, then you might still think you're having your ordinary bleeding and you're not pregnant.
Mm. Which leads to the next question, which everybody wanted to know. Have you ever known anyone to be truly surprised that they were pregnant at birth?
Right up when the baby came.
Yeah.
Yes. I guess I've dealt with this situation a number of times. And, you know, it's a tricky one. To be honest, in the cases that I'll be careful here. In the cases that I've dealt with, there has been issues of family violence and mental health.
Wow.
Where the patient had good reason to conceal the pregnancy. And I don't know, I still don't know whether that's something they did consciously or subconsciously. But I'm sure there have been cases, not in my experience, but I'm sure there have been cases elsewhere of people who had some bleeding right throughout the pregnancy, didn't experience much in the way of fetal movement, were potentially overweight already and the pregnancy wasn't apparent to them or anybody else, who delivered at term or near term without honestly knowing.
I actually got a stat on that.
Yep.
Yep. It is a Google search stat. So like, let's take that with a grain of salt that it is. 1 in 2,500 women go all the way to delivery before realizing they're having a baby.
Yeah. And I don't know. in what percentage of those it was truly not known about, or whether there were other factors that might have meant that concealing that pregnancy was important, and consciously or subconsciously that's why it was concealed.
Mm.
Yeah.
I could imagine, you know, perhaps if it was your first baby and you had PCOS or something like that, where, you know, you had a pretty irregular period anyway, I could imagine getting to a certain point, like, you know, 5 months, 4 months, whatever.
Yeah.
It's very hard not to notice fetal movements.
Well, you would say so, although the people who've had this happen to them have said that they didn't.
Didn't, yeah. All right. Can you have two babies who are not twins? In 2016, Australian Kate Hill became pregnant with two babies and had only had unprotected sex once. She'd been receiving hormone treatments for polycystic ovarian syndrome, PCOS, a condition that decreases ovulation. Doctors discovered that her twins were conceived 10 days apart and the fertilisation was the result of just one ejaculation of sperm. What makes this case even more unusual is that it's generally accepted that sperm have a lifespan of around 5 days. Please explain.
Well, I think if you're on ovulation medication, then the idea of that is to make you ovulate more. And we know people who are on ovulation medication are at much higher risk of having multiple pregnancies, which is why they, which is why we often use ultrasound in a ovulation induction cycle to try and make sure that we're not bringing about multiple pregnancy. So, for example, if you take your letrozole at the start of the month to make your ovaries cough up some eggs, we'll often do an ultrasound around day 12 to make sure there aren't two great big juicy follicles about to be fertilized, about to ovulate, and then the eggs be fertilized. And if it looks like we might be asking for twins or triplets, we could cancel the rest of that cycle and use a lower dose of the medication next month. So what it seems has happened here is that someone's ovulated and fertilized that egg, and then gone on to ovulate again about 10 days later, and that egg has also found its way down the tube. And it would have been quite obvious from the ultrasounds that this difference in the size, if they were 10 days apart. So I guess that is possible, and I guess it doesn't mean they're not twins if they're in the uterus at the same time.
Yeah.
Like, lots of twins come from two eggs, so I don't think that 10 days apart means they're not twins.
I don't know the end of this story for Australian Kate Hill.
I guess it's just that the main thing that normally stops this happening is that when the ovary ovulates, the follicle that lets the egg out, it kind of sends a signal to the other follicles not to bother, not to bother ovulating again. And that's why this doesn't happen all the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And thank God.
Yeah.
And then that just that the sperm lasted for so long, that's probably a little bit unexplainable.
Yeah, that's an interesting part of this case report. If they're sure about that, because that's longer than it's routinely thought that they survive. Yeah.
Mm. All right. Another question we got was, what is a dermoid cyst?
Oh, this is a non-pregnancy carcinoma. So a dermoid cyst is one of those ovarian, usually a cyst within the ovary, and it's called a dermoid cyst or a teratoma, and it's where the within the ovary is a cyst made up of various embryonic stem cells, such that the ovary has had the capacity to mature those stem cells, and then those cells have turned into the whatever cell type they were genetically programmed to turn into. So within the ovary, you can make a cyst that's got tissue from all over your body that's just grown out of those stem cells. So the common things that we see inside them are hair and fat, but also pretty commonly bone, cartilage, teeth. The weirdest thing about the teeth one, I reckon, is that if you pull a tooth out of an ovarian dermoid, it looks like the teeth out of your mouth.
Like an adult tooth?
Oh, yeah, like a tooth that comes out. So, but the strange part about that is I would have thought that to a certain degree the teeth that are in your mouth are that shape because they rub up against your food and all the other teeth. And the ones that come out of the ovary, which have never rubbed up against your food and the other teeth and opening and closing your mouth, they kind of look exactly the same.
Wow.
Yeah. So that's always been of some interest to me. So these are typically benign and will often be diagnosed at the time of a pelvic ultrasound done for pelvic pain or suspected endometriosis or what have you.
Wow, and once if they're benign, but then do they have to be removed?
Yeah, they can get pretty big, so you want to take them out, and you want to take them out at a time when you can still do that laparoscopically, keyhole surgery.
Right.
So you go in with a telescope through the belly button, open the ovary, remove all of the abnormal contents, put that in a plastic bag, and pull it out through the belly button, and then sew the ovary closed again.
Okay, so is your intention to pull that dermoid cyst out as a whole cyst?
Yeah, that's the intention. It's not always possible.
Yeah.
So as with all ovarian cysts, it's nice to pull it out with the cyst still intact, but they'll often break open.
I'm just amazed because stem cells are amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah. In a normal egg, like, where have the stem cells come from? Have they come from an egg or have they come from the actual ovary?
They've come from when the ovary was formed when that woman was a fetus inside her mother.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, and they've just been there and then that's one of the parts of the body where they can fit.
Yeah.
And then under certain conditions can be activated not just to be present but to actually make the tissue in question.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. And for your patients that have had a dermoid cyst, do they find that distressing?
Well, prehistorically, these were thought to be super weird. But you imagine the prehistoric ones. They would only have known it was there if it got like massive and burst out of the person. So they were in the historical, there's historical texts saying that they thought they were a demon going out of the person and stuff. And then more recently, you know, you hear stories of people saying that they had a twin inside their ovary, and those stories mostly relate to dermoid cysts.
Yeah.
So it's not a twin. It's not a fetus.
Fetus at all. There's never been any sperm involvement.
It's just a collection of tissue. And then these days they're typically diagnosed on ultrasound and taken out when they're pretty small. You just want to take it. Well, firstly, you don't know whether they're malignant or not, so you take it out. But also, you want to take it out while it can still be done keyhole.
I always get this confused with the next question, which is a molar pregnancy.
Yeah.
You know why?
Why?
Because I've heard you talk about the dermoid cyst, but the teeth, and then I've gone molar pregnancy.
Oh, right. That's a different type of molar.
Different type of molar, people.
Yeah. Yeah. So a molar pregnancy is another unusual, interesting, fascinomery thing. So molar pregnancy is something that we'll see a few times. Perhaps a few times a year in someone's practice, or once or twice a year, and much more commonly than that in a big city hospital treating thousands of people. So the thing with a molar pregnancy is that the sperm fertilizes the egg, and the egg may be abnormal in certain ways. It might be missing a nucleus, or the maternal genes in that egg otherwise switched off. And you can wind up with a pregnancy that just has multiple copies of the paternal genes, and they can be triploid, which means instead of having two lots of every chromosome, they've got three lots of every chromosome. And in the worst form, there's no baby; there's just a massively overgrown amount of abnormal pregnancy tissue.
Mm.
And you do an ultrasound in early pregnancy expecting to see a baby in there, and all you see is this tissue that looks like a big bunch of grapes, and it's that's the sort of significant form of a molar pregnancy. And occasionally it can lead to a thing called a choriocarcinoma, which is a similar situation where the placental tissue acts like cancer and can spread outside the uterus. And I guess that's the worst thing that this can do. and that needs chemotherapy. It works very well, and the treatment rates are very successful.
Is it classified as cancer?
Yeah. And then the more ordinary, more commonly seen forms of molar pregnancy are picked up in that the woman has an early ultrasound, the sac looks slightly abnormal, there's clearly a miscarriage, she has a miscarriage, and the material from the uterus is sent away to pathology, and it comes back saying, no, this was not a routine miscarriage, it was a molar pregnancy. And there are a couple of things that sometimes have to be followed up in the more significant or severe type of molar pregnancy. And one is that the pregnancy hormone level's gone back to zero. So you've got to, instead of just saying, well, the curette's been done, that's it, we'll try again when we're ready, you have to keep having tests to make sure that the pregnancy hormone's gone all the way back to zero. And the other is that they occasionally recommend a follow-up period where you don't become pregnant again until you've had some expert advice that it's safe to get pregnant again.
Because there's a risk that if you got pregnant again, you'd have another molar pregnancy?
Yes.
Yeah, right.
So.
And is that just a one-off? Like it's just a chromosomal DNA
mess up? Yeah, it's a mess up at that very, very critical early phase.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. I mean, we talk about it before in other episodes how, you know, it's a miracle that.
The miracle it ever works.
Works that you get the right amount of chromosomes from the woman, the right amount from the man. They get together and it forms a fetus that grows and grows and grows until, you know.
Yep.
Super baby complicated in your arms. Process. It's super complicated. Gosh. Mm. Wow. And so how long do people normally have to wait after a curette?
If it's the ordinary type, you don't have to wait at all. And then if it's one of the more complicated types you're testing me here, I think sometimes like 6 months.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. Yep. I'll have to look that up. It's been a little while.
Yeah. Well, obviously that is quite rare then, if you're saying it's been a little while for you.
Big hospitals run molar registries where if you're diagnosed with a molar pregnancy, the registry will follow you up.
Yeah.
And they get you to send urine to them just in the post, and they count up the pregnancy hormone in your urine and make sure that it's all gone. And then they review your case and recommend when it's safe to try again.
Can a pregnancy occur outside of the uterus and the tubes? We know that, you know, they can have an ectopic pregnancy, but even outside that, in the pelvic cavity.
Yeah, definitely. So ectopic just means not in the right place. What we commonly call an ectopic, we should really call a tubal ectopic. Yeah. Because it doesn't mean necessarily it's in the tube; it could be in the ovaries. And there's several. I mean, it's rare, super rare, but there's several reports. From history of baby developing all the way to term outside the uterus.
All the way to term?
Yeah. I think that or you just need a good blood supply that the placenta can attach to. The problem is that the placenta, in order to work properly, needs to be able to sort of join up to the inner wall of the uterus. And it does that in a way that pretty much only the uterus can handle. So those blood vessels grow in, but then when the baby comes out and the uterus contracts down, it very conveniently shears off all those connections and out comes the placenta.
Now that's fascinating.
Yeah, but if the placenta is attached to other things, like, I don't know, the bowel or the iliac artery or something like that, then you're going to be able to you do a cesarean section, get the baby out, no dramas, but the placenta will be grossly abnormally attached to wherever it's getting its blood supply from.
Yeah, wow.
And I think that is the complication.
Oh, well, that would be just dangerous.
Yeah. So I think what's been done in the past is they take out what they can take out surgically, safely, and leave the rest in, and you can leave the rest in and fight another day and go to another operation later on.
Mm.
Or you can treat, you can get rid of placental tissue using a drug called methotrexate, which will kind of treat placental tissue a bit like chemo destroys a tumor.
Yeah, wow.
Yeah.
Have you ever been involved in a non-tubal ectopic pregnancy?
Not outside the uterus, but in the cervix.
Yeah, right.
I've seen two or three of those. So there's a thing called a cervical ectopic, which is potentially quite a dangerous place for the cervix to for the pregnancy to implant, because the inside of the cervix is not somewhere where you want the placenta forming.
Mm.
And if you curette that area intentionally or accidentally to try and interrupt that pregnancy, then it'll bleed an awful lot.
Yeah, right.
So we'll often treat those pregnancies with methotrexate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because there is no potential for that pregnancy to continue.
No, it can't be. It can't. Yeah. Not if it's in the cervix.
Mm.
And I've seen another thing called a corneal ectopic, where the ectopic is right up in the corner of the uterus near the tube opening. And again, it's a dangerous place. If you let that get too big, it will burst. Not just burst out and end the pregnancy, but burst out of the uterus in a way that might also destroy the uterus.
Yeah.
So they also need treatment. And there's a well-described way of treating those surgically by removing the cornu on that side and the tube on the same side. So you wind up with a unicornual uterus like we were talking about before, but not because it formed that way, but because we took one of the corn on the other side off.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
I'm imagining all this is super, super rare.
Yeah, it's rare enough. It's that a tubal ectopic is something that we would deal with in our unit most weeks, and a non-tubal ectopic perhaps once in 3 or 4 years.
Yeah, right. Oh, well, that's still pretty common. Is that anything like a heterotopic pregnancy then?
A heterotopic pregnancy is something else.
I've got some good ones, haven't I?
These are great. A heterotopic pregnancy is something else again. I've seen one of these in my career. That's when there is simultaneously a potentially healthy pregnancy inside the uterus and another pregnancy in somewhere else, most commonly one in the uterus and one in the tube. Yeah. So these are two egg twins, non-identical fraternal twins, where one is implanted normally in the uterus and the other one's stuck in the tube.
So what do we do?
To treat the tubal one like an ordinary ectopic, take the tube out and then leave the other one in the uterus.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. And ideally that happens before the tubal one ruptures. These can all be diagnosed with clever ultrasounds.
So does that mean that it's common practice when you do a early dating scan, you see the baby in the uterus?
Yep.
Do you also check out the tubes?
I think they should. Yeah. I think that a high quality scan would also have a look at the tubes and ovaries.
Yeah. Because you just couldn't predict that unless the ectopic burst. Wow. Okay. Another one is you know when people think that they're pregnant but they're not?
Oh, like a false pregnancy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think people ask interesting questions.
Yeah.
This is rare, and I don't really know much about it. I'd be interested. You've encouraged me. I'm going to have a read about this.
All right. You want to take that one on notice?
I think I better take it on notice.
Okay. Good.
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah.
And I've got
what I don't know is whether this is primarily a mental health issue or whether the symptoms are identical to pregnancy and the person has perfect reason to think they're pregnant. They're pregnant.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. But I'm going to look that up.
Okay. We'll put it as a footnote on another podcast. So if you're listening to something totally unrelated and all of a sudden we start talking about false pregnancy, anyway, we might put it as an Instagram post. And I have one more, Pat.
Yep.
And I'm sure there's way more fascinomas, but I've got one more for you. How can you get a corpus luteum cyst in pregnancy? Somebody wanted to know.
I guess in some ways that happens all the time. I think every pregnancy ever has started off with ovulation, and the bit of the ovary where the egg comes out forms a structure called the corpus luteum, and that corpus luteum makes a hormone called progesterone. And progesterone is part of the normal menstrual cycle, but the whole, the kind of the idea of progesterone is to sustain a normal pregnancy until the placenta kicks in. So a corpus luteum is always present in early pregnancy on whichever ovary ovulated. And a corpus luteal cyst is normally the name we give when that corpus luteum bleeds, especially when it bleeds backwards into the ovary itself and makes this big bruised blood clotty cyst. And so it would sometimes be an ultrasound finding if someone was experiencing severe pain in early pregnancy. We think, oh my God, could this be an ectopic, what have you? Do an ultrasound and we find a big corpus luteal cyst. Needless to say, we're not in a big hurry to operate on it. We'd rather, if someone's pregnant, we'd rather leave them alone. And most of these will settle with time.
Yeah, right.
And the other types of ovarian cyst are commonly found in pregnancy as well. It's very common to find a dermoid in pregnancy and then just leave it there. If it's got all benign features, do some blood tests, make sure there's no sense that it's a cancerous tumour. And then leave it there and then go back after the pregnancy, perhaps 8-10 weeks later, and take it out laparoscopically.
Yeah, right. I wonder why that person asked that question, whether they thought maybe they'd ovulated again while they were pregnant and that's why they had a...
Yeah, I think that's much less likely to be the explanation. They're probably talking about a corpus luteal cyst that was diagnosed in early pregnancy when they were already pregnant, but long after the corpus luteum formed.
Yeah, good. That does make sense. Excellent. All right. Well, I bet you've got more that you've seen in your lifetime. You and I might have to have a chat and we'll see if we've missed any.
Yeah, if people are interested, they can certainly contact us, DM us and ask about some of these rare and unusual things.
Yeah, great. Well, I hope that was an interesting topic for everybody. We had fun. Well, I had fun building it and I had fun stumping Pat. That doesn't happen very often. Good. Thank you very much for listening. And if you have time, it would mean the world to us if you jumped on to Apple Podcasts or Spotify and give us a rating. 5 stars would be great.
If you don't mind.
If you don't mind. Because it really means a lot to us. It keeps us energized. It keeps us enthused. And it gets us back here on the mics recording another podcast for you to listen to. Until then,
thanks for listening, everybody.
Bye for now.